Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Welcome to Life Under Code Orange, Day 10. The hardware stores are picked clean, supermarkets are trying to keep up with the demand for bottled water and canned soup, and today there's word that another message from Osama bin Laden may soon appear. President Bush, speaking at FBI headquarters last week, says this nation remains at war and that the risk of another terrorist attack remains high.
We're tracking and confronting and defeating international terror. Within our own country, we're taking unprecedented measures to protect the American people against a serious and continuing danger. There is no such thing as perfect security against a hidden network of cold-blooded killers. Yet abroad and home, we're not going to wait till the worst dangers are upon us. Continue to be in a state of war.
This state of war, according to the president, is one that now includes Saddam Hussein as well.
This war requires us to understand that terror is broader than one international network. That these terrorist networks have got connections, in some cases, to countries run by outlaw dictators. And that's the issue with Iraq. When I speak about the war on terror, I don't only talk about Al-Qaeda. I talk about Iraq, because after all, Saddam Hussein has got weapons of mass destruction, and he's used them.
And so heeding warnings from the Department of Homeland Security and fearing threats from everything from biological weapons, chemical weapons, nuclear weapons, stateless shadowy terrorists, and states like Iraq, this country wrapped itself in fear and turned into duct tape nation last week. Connection listeners, this hour we're talking about the history and the politics of national alerts. What do we have to learn from the 1950s, for example? Is there a better way to warn a nation about a threat? And how does the psychology of fear translate into the psychology of war? Our number's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We start the show in the snowbound nation's capital. Dana Milbank is White House correspondent with the Washington Post. And I gather, Dana, you're joining us from your home phone. Snowed in, are you?
Snowed in. Just crawled out from under my bed.
So another threat to add to everything else. Dana, just before we talk about duct tape, I'm interested in some thoughts from you on how this week will begin in Washington, because the people at the White House will have to digest the newspaper headlines and photographs of the millions marching around the weekend.
You have to clarify whether we're talking about people marching in this country or marching elsewhere. And the fact of the matter is, in this country, the demonstrations against conflict with Iraq have been a little bit too little and too late. Now, they're going to be uneasy to see that there are millions in the street in Europe and elsewhere, but they're already well aware of public opinion over there. And while the president and his advisors see international support as desirable, they do not see it as necessary. So there's nothing in what's happening overseas that would really deter them at all in the way they've been proceeding.
I can imagine someone who was standing in the cold in New York listening to you saying, what, too little, too late? No, we were there in the thousands. They've got to pay attention. But you're saying they won't.
They won't particularly pay attention to that, but the other thing is the demonstrators have indeed domestically come out in the last couple of months or so, but this was pretty much all set at least at the very beginning of last year, and I think it snuck up on a lot of people, and the process is really in motion and was and by the time the United Nations passed its resolution last year, there was really no turning back from it.
Right. Dana, tell me, if you were able to brush the snow away from the front window and look across the street, would you be seeing windows and doors with duct tape around the edges? I mean, just measure this for us.
Well, you would certainly hope not, because what people didn't really sort out is if they do a real good job of sealing themselves in, they'll run out of oxygen pretty quickly. So I don't think we've had reports of our first terror-related asphyxiations. But the duct tape thing has become, I think, something of a joke nationwide. And it's a bit of a joke even here in the Capitol, because it's sort of like Jimmy Carter during the energy crisis telling us to put on a sweater. Like, it, well, and that may be useful, but it doesn't really get at the heart of the problem. But the duct tape element of it aside, the Capitol has definitely been in something of a panic. You can tell by the way people have flocked to the stores. To one supermarket yesterday had two bottles of Gatorade. That was the only fluid still available in the
And you got them both, did you?
I've been hoarding for a while.
Tell me about Orange Alert, though, whether or not that's something that just in your regular daily life in Washington you see as having changed the way people are behaving.
I'm surprised to the extent to which it has, and people are often surprised, even those of us in the press who are covering this all the time are surprised by how much we've been swept away by it, really. There are certain precautions that we find ourselves taking. If you can avoid taking the metro, it seems the likeliest place for chemical and biological attacks. So people have been trying to avoid that. There's been a lot of searching in the workplace for what provisions have we made. Do we all have protective hoods? I mean, the fact of the matter is you find out that everybody in working in the Capitol and the congressional office buildings, everybody working in the White House complex has a hood. The question is, those of us working a couple blocks away, if we don't have them, have we left ourselves vulnerable?
All right, Dana, we will track this. I want to thank you for taking the time from your snow shoveling to
Certainly.
Join us today. Dana Milbanks, White House correspondent with The Washington Post. Now, it did come to pass late last week that all the attention that was being paid to duct tape and plastic sheeting finally penetrated the public relations part of Homeland Security. And a rather frustrated Secretary Tom Ridge appeared at a news conference late last week.
I want to make something very, very clear at this point. We do not want individuals or families to start sealing their doors or their windows. It is very appropriately listed in the list of supplies for an emergency supply kit. Those supplies could be used in response to certain kinds of terrorist attacks.
Secretary of Homeland Security Tom Ridge speaking last Friday. Two guests with me this hour to talk about the historical handling of such threats, the mix of national security and politics. Here in the studio, Eric Kupferberg. He lectures on the history of science at Harvard University and specializes in the history of bacteriology and public attitudes towards germs. Hi, Eric.
Good morning, Dick.
And joining us from the NPR studios of KPCC in Pasadena, California, is Laura McEnany. She is the author of Civil Defense Begins at Home, Militarization Meets Everyday Life in the 50s. She teaches history at Whittier College in California. Hi, Laura.
Good morning, Dick.
Laura, I'm going to start with you because I'm interested in knowing just your sense of how well or how badly the White House has been managing its information to the public over the past week. What's your sort of sense of it?
Well, I don't think they've been handling it any differently than they handled it in the 1950s as the government was coping with explaining the nuclear weapon to the American people. There is incoherence, there is confusion, there's a little bit of chaos. So I see a lot of parallels between now and the 1950s in terms of trying to convey this permanent state of war, this way of life to American citizens.
Is it because it can't be done well? That you can't have it both ways?
Well, I think it's unfolding. I mean, I think it's hard to say what it is now because I don't think that our government understands exactly what it is, and they're struggling to explain it themselves. In the 1950s, there was a similar situation in terms of their struggling to explain it to people. But what they did convey was a very clear sense of an internal enemy, a very clear message of an external enemy. But the more they talked, it became clear that there was more information but more abstraction. And that's what I think is happening today. There's more talk, but there's not necessarily more information.
Eric, what do you think? Buy some duct tape, don't use it. Maybe we'll stay at, orange alert. Maybe we won't. It's hard actually to know how to respond to that kind of, those kinds of signals.
I think actually what was interesting is your White House and Washington correspondent reported that the press in Washington had considered duct tape finally to be a joke. And before we dismiss it as a joke, I kind of want to mention that jokes themselves can be pretty good windows in American culture. I often consider jokes to be an indication of what's the limit of how much we can take. And at least from my own experience in doing research on the history of germs, is that germs themselves serve as sort of cultural markers. They are an indication of cultural practices of what we consider to be threats, and they're perfect for this particular war. Germs are unseen. They're hidden. They're everywhere. They're insidious. They're imbued with malicious intentions. And usually we ascribe our fears of germs onto marginalized groups, blacks, Jews, women, homosexuals, etc. But that's during times of low threat. Times of heavy threat, the fear of germs becomes almost uncontrollable. And one of the things...
Well, in a way, the administration is legitimizing the fear of germs by including biological weapons
absolutely.
Among the threats, right?
Absolutely. And to some extent, people have historically placed their cultural fears or political fears or national fears onto germs. It's a way of displacing them outward. The problem is that it doesn't do anything for the fear. Asking people to buy duct tape means that they can imagine a scenario where they would have to seal themselves in. But that doesn't do anything for fear, nor does it do anything to actually protect yourself against a real threat.
What do you mean it doesn't do anything for fear? I would have thought that it actually raises the level of fear.
It doesn't resolve the fear.
Okay.
Doesn't pose any solution to it. Now, in many ways, actually, I thought with duct tape last week when they originally announced it was a perfect move in that it allowed people to address the fear. It's a wonderful solution. Buying duct tape is individualistic. You don't need to spend that much money as a community or as a nation. It's low tech. We don't need to rely on experts. It's something visible. It's something familiar. It's something that we have often thought of as being useful for everything. So at some sort of psychological level, holding a roll of duct tape, or as I'm finding out, holding an entire case of duct tape makes you feel like you're doing something. Right. Unfortunately, that feeling of protection, of satisfaction lasts maybe a half hour, 45 minutes, before you realize you cannot duct tape yourself entirely from any outside of infection or contamination.
So a bit of busy work then, maybe, Laura.
Yeah. I mean, that's the way I understood it, that it was something to keep us busy. It was similar to what the government was telling us to do after the terrorist attacks, go to work, go to the mall, fly, and, you know, perhaps scrutinize our mail and wash our hands after handling it. But it's keeping people busy. And at that level, I agree with Eric, it's a sort of psychological comfort. But again, much like in the 50s, this didn't resolve the fear. It temporarily displaced it, but it did not resolve it. And again, it did not provide people with real information.
Connection listeners, our number is 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about the psychology of fear, the management of it by the administration, and whether or not it translates into a psychology of war. What's the connection? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by TechFusion, restructuring...
You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. I need you to come back with me now for a moment. 1949, that was the year when the Soviet Union exploded its first nuclear device. and a year when people in this country realized that the U.S. monopoly on nuclear weapons was no longer there, and at least in theory, this country was more vulnerable than it had been at any time in its history. And there was an animated film that was produced at the time. It was called Duck and Cover, first, I think, released in 1950. It starred Bert the Turtle.
Threatened him, he never got hurt. He knew just what to do. He ducked and covered. Ducked and covered.
He did what we all must learn to do.
You and you
and you
and you. Ducked and covered.
Be sure and remember what Bert the Turtle just did, friends, because every one of us must remember to do the same thing. That's what this film is all about. Duck and cover.
I wonder if the dum-dum at the end is intentional. Duck, tape, and cover. With me on the program this hour, I have Laura McEnany. She's author of Civil Defense Begins at Home. Eric Kupferberg's with me. He's a lecturer on the history of science at Harvard University. Eric, I'm going to start with you. The 1950s civil defense message, did it make any more sense at that time than the sort of thing that we're talking about now?
Well, fortunately, I can say I wasn't alive during the 1950s, but I actually think it probably did make more sense, in part because it was a communal activity. It was a national activity with concrete scenarios, maybe unrealistic concrete scenarios, but concrete scenarios nonetheless. And it was taught through the school system, which I believe is a nice way of having a consistent message being passed around from neighborhood to neighborhood to neighborhood.
So rather than judging the idea of having those kids in short pants crawl under their desk, it's
right.
how effective was it
right.
at the time, right?
Right. However, I think probably the duck and cover films and the current instructions of a disaster kit are counterproductive. They detract from meaningful debate that we should be having right now by going out and spending all of our time and money on duct tape and then laughing about it and then feeling uncomfortable about laughing in the circumstances that lead to it. We're not talking about the risks of smallpox vaccinations. Who should be vaccinated? Who should pay?
Okay, I want to get to that in a minute. But Laura, let me hear from you on the 1950s campaign. I mean, because it was more than just safety and security. That those campaigns were part of teaching America to fear a certain enemy.
Yeah, I mean, civil defense was many things, actually. It was a national security agency, so in a sense it was part of that secretive world of planning for World War III. It was a military theory that held that you could survive a nuclear war. And it was a propaganda effort, and that's where you see the duck and cover efforts. And it was a propaganda effort to build consensus around atomic diplomacy, the idea that nuclear weapons stand at the core of American foreign policy. But I do want to make the point that in some ways, Eric is right, it was a communal activity, but the federal government never argued that it was important for them to pay for American citizens' defense. Civil defense was privatized in the 1950s so that...
You mean build your own shelter in the backyard.
That's a great point.
Exactly. The cost of military preparedness was shifted to the private citizen. But, of course, it was hailed as a sort of American-style militarization. That is, you purchased it. You consumed it. And that's what made America great. That's what made us a consumer capitalist society counterposed to the Soviet Union.
But how many people actually did build a fallout shelter, though?
Very, very few. In fact, we don't know the numbers on this. These are unknowable numbers because civil defense was voluntary and self-reported. The government didn't track the number of people who built fallout shelters. So any numbers, as one of the people I interviewed for the book said, are educated guesswork. So a tiny, tiny percentage of American people built shelters in the 1950s. But I have to say that that doesn't mean that wasn't a no-confidence vote on national security. People accepted a much higher level of militarization outside their homes than they did inside their homes.
For example, what?
Well, people accepted the tax burden of atomic diplomacy mm-hmm. and supported the Cold War's nuclear arsenal, but they refused to militarize their private spaces at a level asked for them and with the zeal asked for them by the federal government.
I actually think that's a great point Laura is making. And in some respects, militarizing our home, that is, protecting ourselves from any number of unseen threats from biological agents to chemical attacks, arguably creates an increased fervor for war right now by sealing up a home or imagining ourselves sealing up a home stuck with a week supply of bottled water and a week supply or 2 week supply of food. To some extent, psychologically makes our lives very similar to a life in a Tora Bora cave. It's an inversion of which country and which nation, which civilization is more civilized.
Are you saying this is intentional?
No. I cannot make that argument.
What do you think, Laura? I mean, the idea that by creating a certain level of expectation of fear, does that connect with the administration's other current policy about building up support for an attack on Iraq?
I agree with Eric. I think it's hard to say at this point, but I do think that the sort of residual effect is building a political culture around fear, and that that the duct tape is a distraction from asking real questions about how this discourse of duct tape and plastic sheathing is helping us deal with the international situation. It's not. It's we should be talking about weightier topics.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's get some of those weightier topics from our callers. First to Glenn, who's joining us from Frankfort, Kentucky. Hi, Glenn.
Hi. An important topic.
Thanks for calling.
You know, I guess one of the things I'd like to say is that it seems like, for one, I'm concerned about the manipulation of the public by this fear. And, you know, Americans have traditionally accepted levels of risk. I mean, we inhabited this continent, which is a very dangerous place, and we accepted levels of risk. And I think we were living in a new reality now. Mm-hmm. And a lot of things come to mind. You know, Roosevelt's statement about, you know, nothing to fear but fear itself. And I think one of the New England states, maybe New Hampshire, have lived free or die. And I think that the thing about being free and fear, there's something that's a counter-opposed. You know, if you have too much fear, you can't be free. And I think it's sort of a, I don't know, it's really sort of demeaning to Americans to increase a level of fear such that you are able to manipulate them into accepting less freedom.
Do you think that the authorities then, if they're going to raise these alerts, Glenn, should say more about why they're being raised?
Well, I think that we pretty much understand that we're living in a different world. And, yes, well, that's part of it. But, you know, I think somebody even said on the news, one of the officials, too, we can't really determine, I mean, if an attack is imminent. I mean, all we know is that we're living in a more dangerous world. And what are we going to do about it? And one of the things I think that it's inevitable that that there's going to be another event. And the thing is that we have to just learn to accept it, just like our forefathers accepted the risks of going in across the Rocky Mountains or into unknown places. I mean, it's just a different reality. It's unfortunate, but it's another reality that we have to live with.
Laura McEnany, I wonder whether or not, in your view, the government is underestimating people by giving out the amount of information that is given out.
Well, I think that they are. And again, I have to be careful here because I give observations as a historian, but I'm also experiencing this as a citizen as well. But I think that we need to think about the kinds of questions we should be asking. We all talk about living in a new society, adapting to a new reality, without asking real questions about how we construct this new national security state. How permanent do we want to be? Are we in this for the long haul? What kinds of U.S. foreign policies do we need to be talking about instead of talking about duct tape? So I think that, again, there are some real questions out there, and the fear, raising the level of fear, doesn't help us discuss those rationally, even angrily at times, and it's too much of a distraction at this point.
I totally agree. I think that the fear factor causes us to sort of this hunkering down, and I'm of the generation who actually went through those duck and cover exercises in grammar school.
Right.
But I totally agree. I think that by having the fear element there, you sort of detract from a rational dialogue on maybe how you could minimize or mitigate some of the risk involved in a nonviolent way. Fear, you sort of get into this mode that of survival mode where it's us against you, and you know it's. And I think makes war more likely.
And Eric, this is what you were talking about. What should we be? What should the conversation be if it's not just, you know, tape and fear and fear and tape?
Well, once again, like Laura, I'm making observations from an historian's point of view. And Glenn has a very good point about fear trading off with freedom. But at least historically, fear has always made Americans beholden to governmental officials. In times of epidemics, we are beholden to local or state or national public health officials. And we would hope that they would give us advice that is concrete, that's based upon good information, and that allows us to take remedial actions to avoid a contagion. At times, however, the kinds of responses that governments have made have been just as misguided. The example that comes to mind is the early 20th century polio in New York City, before that we knew that it was communicated through a virus that actually wasn't based upon dirt.
Right.
The New York City officials blamed immigrants, blamed the dirty, filthy habits of so-called, you know, Italian or Irish immigrants. It's only later did we realize that it's the rich kids who were going to summer camps that actually were getting polio. But as far as the trade-off for meaningful discussions is concerned, I do believe that we should be talking about things like the overburdened healthcare system or the fact that many people don't have access to healthcare. At a times of a crisis, we will have to get people through hospitals, through first response teams, and we don't have those in place. And we don't have a meaningful discussion about them.
You're listening to The Connection from NPR. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Next to Cambridge, and Margaret's joining us. Hi, Margaret.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, go ahead.
I think maybe this is something that's continuing what the very last topic was, but growing up in Massachusetts, my older sister is 9 years older than me. She was sort of at the very beginning of the what we'd call a baby boomer generation, the way they sort of had set those years aside. And I was at the other end of it. And I remember being a five-year-old child and watching. My sister was actually allowed to make for her own benefit and her own comfort. And my parents said, sure, go right ahead and put all the supplies in the basement. And I remember seeing a corner of the basement set aside with cans of peas and bandages and wrappers, the old, you know, the Johnson, not to be an advertisement here, but the Red Cross sign on the packages and things like that, and not really understanding what that was about. Now, my sister was part of the duck and hide generation. I was not... I didn't have to participate in any of that by the time I got to school. And now her response out in Ohio is that she is buying duct tape and sealing windows and taking some other measures and setting food aside. I'm wondering if there is a generational difference, and I'm wondering if it has something to do with post-trauma. You know, people who have been through this before have a much stronger effect. And I'll just make one more very brief comment. The only thing analogous I can bring into my own lifetime where I've had this sort of response or observed it in my friends is the sort of thing where it's a much more internal within our borders threat, but people
right.
who have fear for their young children, taking them out to, let's say, children's days on Saturdays and having them fingerprinted and feeling that they're protecting them in that way. And I've never done that because I've always felt, my God, it's a terrifying idea that the only reason those fingerprints are ever useful is in the worst-case scenario. But that's something that parents do, for instance, I don't know if it makes anyone feel safer, especially the children who go home with this stuff on their fingers. So,
Margaret, let me interrupt and ask Laura if there is a lesson in history here, a generational thing that Margaret's talking about.
Absolutely. I when you talk to people about the 1950s, the first story that will come up from their childhood is Duck and Cover or the Bert the Turtle cartoons that they received at school. When I explain the Duck and Cover maneuver to my students, they laugh out loud. In fact, I have them duck under their desks and ask them, you know, is this the maneuver of a superpower? How powerful do you feel when you're doing this? And that gets to another point I wanted to make about alarm and confidence. I think it's not just the fear, as our last caller pointed out, but it's also a projection of confidence that we're afraid, but we also have the confidence of being the world superpower, the military superpower. And this was a concern in the 1950s, that we had to inject enough fear into the population so they would take action, duck and cover, build a shelter, and so forth, mm-hmm. but that the military, in the end, could save us. And walking that fine line was very difficult, that you had to project American power, but also fear, so that people would participate.
It's an interesting point that you're making, Laura, because at the tail end of Secretary Ridge's news conference, he was actually talking about the fact that it's not up to the average person to fight this war against terror.
I mean, the war on terrorism will be won by the professionals. They'll be won by the professionals at the borders. They'll be run by the Coast Guard and the customs officials and by the military and the CIA and the FBI. They are the frontline troops. But there are things that individual citizens and families can do to help protect themselves and their families, which we think are appropriate and necessary. And so this is an educational campaign. We're going to sustain it over a long period of time, and we've had, I think, terrific support from a lot of people so we can get the message out.
Now, this educational campaign that Secretary Ridge is talking about, Eric, is something that the government is rolling out on Wednesday, 2 days from now. They're going to call it the Ready Campaign. Secretary Ridge refused to give any details about it. He said if he did, nobody would show up to the announcement news conference that he's got scheduled for that day. But what could be different? How can the message be either massaged or changed or altered or made more useful?
Well, there's several things that we could do. The first of which is to have more neighborhood coordination. I mean, one of the things that the people need to realize is that during any crisis, whether it be a biological or a chemical attack or something much more likely or much more common like a hurricane or tornado or 5 feet of snow, might be exits from your home. Where is your power? How do you shut off the power if need be? Who in your neighborhood is a physician? Who in your neighborhood has a four-wheel truck? Who in your neighborhood is elderly or sick? Who has children that might be latchkey kids? Where are you going to meet your children in times of emergency? Those sorts of concrete actions could be taken and could be coordinated at a much more local level, possibly with federal funding. If we look at these mundane practices, it might be the fact that people don't take them because they're mundane. We think, oh, gee, that's obvious. It's much more exciting and much more likely to generate action if it is a greater threat and more exotic cures.
All right, 1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, we're talking about Duct Tape Nation and how the message could be changed and whether or not the message of the threats and the message of war are somehow getting a little bit muddied. 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Coming up in the hour number two of The Connection with Dick Gordon.
You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. With me in the studio, Eric Kupferberg. He teaches a class in the history of germs at the Department of the History of Science at Harvard University and specializes in the history of public attitudes towards germs. Laura McEnany's with us. She's the author of Civil Defense Begins at Home, Militarization Meets Everyday Life in the 50s. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Straight out to Greensboro, North Carolina. David's joining us. Hi, David.
Hello.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
What's on your mind?
My concern is how that a lot of people take pot shots and criticize the Bush administration, like what we just went through, updating the alert status.
Right.
And yet nothing has happened. And then they start making, jokes or comments about it. And if something would have happened, then it would have been equally as critical for them not taking appropriate action. And what may have been averted, we don't know. What could have been avoided by the extra alert status, we may never know. So how can we have it both ways, to criticize the president if he doesn't take appropriate action or if he overreacts?
Okay, fair question. Eric, do you want to speak to David on this?
Sure, absolutely. I do think it's reasonable to assume that the threat is real. The question is, how is the threat real in our everyday lives, and what are the probabilities? And what sort of solutions are being offered to us, and under what circumstances can we take them? I think most of the criticisms has not been that the Bush administration is overreacting. It's how they are telling us about a threat. A code orange in and of itself doesn't do much for us on our daily lives. We're not quite sure what it means to keep our eyes open for something suspicious. Moreover, the kinds of solutions that have been suggested to us have batteries, have a radio, have a few days' worth of water, and buy duct tape, seemed almost ridiculous in the face of the threat that was being communicated.
Although the suggestions of putting together an emergency kit
absolutely
have everything to do with the risk of a flood or a tornado or any kind of...
Earthquakes.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Depending upon what country.
So, Laura, we should have that stuff anyway, right?
Right. We should have that stuff anyway. You know, and what's interesting about the civil defense efforts in the 1950s is how they morphed into natural disaster planning by the 1960s and 1970s. And, you know, just to address the caller, I think some of that criticism was real confusion, genuine confusion, and that the pot shots that he identified were really jokes that were exposing a level of anxiety about what is unknowable about this, because there is so much that is unknowable at this point.
And as I said also earlier, jokes are sometimes a response when we can't take the anxiety anymore.
David, are you still there?
Yes, sir. Hold on just for a second. Okay.
Yeah, I'm curious to know what you saw and what you heard in Greensboro. Were the newspapers full of photographs of people lining up to buy duct tape? Did you watch the television, you know, saying breaking news, orange alert?
Well, there wasn't I didn't see a whole lot of extra activity. I was in a Sam's in Greensboro, and there was a lot of people there. I did see one generator, but I think that was for the impending ice storm that we had. So I don't know that there was a large reaction to it.
All right, David. Thanks for your call.
Thank you, sir.
Let's talk a little bit, if we can, Laura and Eric, about the way that the message gets out. Because in the 1950s, I have to assume that people were taking this in a way that was a lot different from same-day newspaper photographs, websites saying, you know, showing folks lining up at the hardware store and all the cable television news channels, Laura, with their flashing banners saying breaking news, orange alert, everybody buying duct tape.
Right. You would be exposed to this information from the Civil Defense Administration in your movie theater, at your grocery store, at a PTA meeting, a brochure at the post office. There was time to digest it. And as you said today, most of it comes to us in flashes.
I think the other difference is right now, I believe that the media consumer is much more cynical. And also much more willing to double-check information, to surf the web, to find alternative news sources. As a result, getting a consistent message about civil defense, or in this case, preparedness for potential attacks or disasters, is much more difficult to control. I also think that consumers of media information have not been told which are authoritative places to find information. Just this morning, I was looking at the FEMA website, which is fabulous. Describes a series of scenarios of possible attacks or disasters of all sorts of kinds, and particular remedial measures that could be taken both in advance and post-disaster.
1-800-423-8255. Next to Chatham, Massachusetts, and Knut's joining us. Hi there.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks for calling.
Thank you. I just think this whole thing is a total overreaction. I mean, it's almost like War of the Worlds type of reaction. You can't do anything about it. If they're going to have chemical or biological, it has to be a very sophisticated delivery system, and these people don't have it. You know, and but by the time you know it, you're either dead or you're still alive. I mean, so everybody ought to get a grip and go on with their lives. I mean, I don't think the FBI and the CIA have people in place that can find out, you know, what these guys are doing, because we don't have many people that speak Arabic in the service, so... Yeah, that's my point.
Let me ask you a question, though, Knut. If they are, in fact, getting all these indications that maybe there'll be something else and maybe it'll be something like September 11th and they don't know, which is sort of what Laura was saying earlier, what are they to do under those circumstances?
tell people to go about their lives. We're doing the best we can to take care of things, and to trust us. I mean, I think it's also a distraction from what's really going on in this country that needs addressing, jobs, health care, and everything else.
You think it's intentional?
I don't know if it's intentional. I would hate to think that they would do that, but I think before the election they were doing it, yes.
I actually believe that while the sophisticated kinds of attacks probably aren't likely in the near future, low-level attacks or low-tech attacks using biological or chemical weapons aren't that hard. And there are a number of small measures that we could take individually, one of which is that when you walk into a shopping mall or to a movie theater, notice where the exits are. They used to have, here at Lowe's Theaters in the Boston area, signs when you walked in or the little clips that would come on before the meeting, before the movie, you know, saying, notice where your exits are. And in emergency, a case of a fire or other emergency, walk, don't run to the exits. And you'd notice where three or four of them are. Those are the sorts of things that we should be preparing. Also, planned evacuations and rehearsals of evacuations from your workplace offices, that might help.
Laura, go ahead.
Yeah, I wonder about people's willingness to stay mentally ready, as this caller said, instead of just moving on. It was very difficult in the 1950s to convince people that they should be on constant alert, even at a low level, packing supplies, planning a family evacuation route. It was very difficult to instill in people that level of apprehension while also telling them to go on about their normal lives because, as Tom Ridge said, the professionals were going to take care of things. And I think that tension in the 1950s was never resolved, as I don't see it being resolved today, that tone between alarm and confidence at every public service announcement about this.
And you've also made the observation, Laura, that in the 1950s, the people who we were supposed to fear were our neighbors. They could be anybody. They could be the Rosenbergs. There was nothing identifiable, which is, again, something that made it a little bit more pervasive then?
I think so. I mean, the fear of the internal enemy, understanding all domestic developments as potential threats to us in the same way that we understood all global threats as potentially harmful to the United States, really contributed to that culture of fear, really built that political culture of fear. Today, I think the fear of the internal enemy is a little more racialized. That is, it's targeted at the Muslim citizen. And so I think that while there were sort of stock characterizations of the 1950s communist, I think today's internal enemy has a more racial cast to it.
You're listening to The Connection from NPR. Knut, thanks for your call. 1-800-423-8255. Next to Somerville, Massachusetts, and Angelica is joining us. Hi, Angelica.
Hi. That's a great show. Thank you for having us. I'm a kid of the 70s and 80s in Germany, and I think it's interesting to make the international comparison here a little bit. If Germany would have been struck by fear the same way America is at the moment, I think the country would have been paralyzed in the 70s and 80s. 60s equally, you would think it was so much closer to the threat. And I'm wondering if, in a smaller degree, that's what's happening here right now, too. Whereas in Germany in the 70s, you have a very vivid debate about disarmament, about ecological improvements. That was only possible because people were not constantly fearing an attack from the East Bloc. And here I'm wondering if how much debate do we lose by being constantly talking about what could happen and how can we get enough water and duct tape. I wonder if the debate wouldn't be much more viable and then much more vivid here if this constant fear wouldn't be a part of the society.
I wonder if the feeling in West Germany in the 70s and the 80s would have been any different if the wall was not there, if the possibility of people coming back and forth was what we see now today.
Well, I think it's a general thing in Europe, though. I've also lived in Ireland for a while, and just always, just coming into this country, even before September 11, I felt that fear is much more prevalent in this country, and I have to say that it surprised me when I came in and said, a documentary of Michael Moore, Bowling for Columbine, seemed to point that out, too, that in part by the media, in part by politicians, this feeling of fear seems to be much stronger installed here than in Canada, for example, but I also would argue in Europe in general.
The fear, you're talking about a fear that you were aware of before 9/11.
Yeah, even that. I mean, I think that's more Michael Moore's point in his movie, that he's bringing into the context of weapons in this country, of guns and arms.
All right, I'm going to ask Eric just to talk about the way that different perceptions of fear can work from people who've seen it in other parts of the world. Eric.
Yeah, I'm a little bit worried that fear is not sustainable and that we're faced with sort of a binary choice, either absolute inaction or absolute terror. And I'm amazed that other countries have been able to manage that continuum, to find a middle ground between the two. I know that the usual example is pointed towards Israel, which has lived with the threat of attack, both of, you know, bombings and buses and also gas and biological attack for some time. And how do they go about managing, as well as sort of educating the public and rehearsing disaster actions? But then again, I heard also this morning that more people had died from asphyxiation of putting on their gas mask in 1991 than actually died of any Scud missile attack. So I think inherently it's difficult to negotiate. What is it about America? Well, because we don't face this threat that is constant, because the threats tend to be episodic and explosive. That means we're not used to personal mechanisms of how to negotiate.
And Laura, we hear from the Secretary of Homeland Security that the threat is likely to be reduced from orange down to yellow. I wonder what that'll mean when the threat goes back up to orange again. I mean, will people make those adjustments?
I don't know that they'll act any differently than they're acting now. I mean, when people wake up, I'm not sure what their level awareness is of how they're going to change their behavior because we're on orange alert versus yellow alert. It's not really clear to me how this is going to unfold, because I don't think it's really clear to Tom Ridge what Homeland Security is going to mean. How is it going to be administered? How is this going to be a federal effort, a local effort? As Eric was saying earlier, local efforts might be more successful. But I would point out that whenever it's raised from yellow to orange, mayors, governors get very agitated, because one of the issues here is the unfunded mandate. There has been very little money distributed to states, but the expectation that cities and states will protect themselves and bear this burden. And that was also true in the 1950s. Mayors and governors were constantly crying about lack of funding to help them fight this internal and external enemy.
We're going to have to spend more than we would spend on a case of duct tape, I guess. Laura, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Laura McEnany is the author of Civil Defense Begins at Home, Militarization Meets Everyday Life in the 50s. Eric Kupferberg, thanks for coming back.
Thank you for having me.
Eric's a lecturer on the history of germs at Harvard University. Earlier in the program, we talked with Dana Milbank, White House correspondent for The Washington Post. Connection listeners, we invite you to continue the conversation in our online forums. We're at theconnection.org. Our program's produced by Sean Carberry, Sarah Field, Elaine Grant, Kelly Jones, Orit Karitsky-Fox, Lindsay Miller, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugarts. Our interns are Dania Akkad and Kevin Sangudi. Tara Murphy is our senior producer. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Purchase cassettes and CDs of The Connection, please visit www.theconnection.org or phone 1-800-909-9287.